For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, God, thanks for Moses as an example who messed up and then was willing to say yes to you much later in life, God. And thank you, too, that you don't leave the story there and make it sound like it's just going to be all easy once we do say yes, but that thanks that you show us life and following you as it really is, and that it's not as easy as it seems. It's not exactly as the way we would plan it, and I pray that our understanding of what it means to serve you, to say yes to you, that that would be expanded here as we look at Moses' life. Amen. Yeah, so this is some early experiences in the life of a guy named Moses who went on to become one of the greatest known figures of all time. And these early experiences of his, as God is working with him to make him the kind of guy that can be used for a very, very significant task, These are the parts of the story that I kind of forgot were there. And so I went back and I restudied this story a few years ago, and I felt like there's some really important insights for us. There were important insights for me. I felt like God really spoke to me. And so this morning I'd like to share with you some of the things that I felt like God showed me. Just a little reminder, so far in the book of Exodus, we saw a lot of this last week. God's people, the Hebrews, the Israelites, they are slaves in Egypt. They've been there for almost 400 years. Some portion of that has been under harsh and brutal slavery. Intense persecution by Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. There was a point where he was trying to exterminate the Hebrew population and assimilate them into the Egyptians. And so he said, I want all the baby boys to be killed. One particular baby boy, though, was rescued. A guy named Moses, who ended up spending 40 years being raised in the palace, adopted by Pharaoh's daughter, raised with all of the privileges that came with being basically a prince. Somebody who, if the right turn of events had happened, he could have been in line for the throne. At the very least, he would have been trained for a very high-ranking, important government position. But at a certain point, Moses, who knew that he was a Hebrew by birth, he went out, he looked at the Hebrews, he identified with them. He did something real stupid. He killed a guy. And then he had to flee. He killed one of the Egyptians for beating one of the Israelites. And so he had to flee. And he spent the next 40 years thinking that he had failed in the opportunity he had to free God's people. And he lived as a shepherd, a quiet life in the middle of nowhere. Nobody noticed him. He had a family. He had a wife. He had a couple of kids. And then one day God showed up and he called Moses to go back to Egypt to lead the people into freedom. And Moses, we saw last week, he had objection after objection. Finally, God answers his objections, calls him to go forward, and Moses agrees. And so we see that he says yes to God. Yes, I will go back in, even though he's 80 years old at this point, even though he's already tried this once and failed, even though he'd been rejected by his own people. He agrees, and he says yes, and he loads up his family, and he heads back to Egypt. We'll pick up the story in Exodus 4. Verse 27, now Yahweh had said to Aaron, that was Moses' brother, who's 83 at this time, go out into the wilderness to meet Moses. You can imagine Aaron praying day after day for 83 years for freedom. He hadn't seen his brother in over 40 years, and now one day God says, hey Aaron, I want you to go out to Mount Sinai. I want you to meet up with your brother because things are going to start to move here. And so Aaron went out and he met Moses at the mountain of God and he embraced him. And the two brothers, they reunite after being apart for so long. It says Moses told Aaron everything that Yahweh had commanded him to say. Remember, Aaron was supposed to be the speaker because Moses didn't feel too good about his speaking ability. And Aaron does speak at first, but eventually Moses ends up taking over as we read the narrative. And it turns out with God's power, with the words of God, he ends up being a little better speaker than he thought he was. Moses told Aaron the miraculous signs Yahweh had commanded him to perform. He shows him the snake, that, you know, the staff turning into the snake and back again. He shows him the old disappearing leprosy trick. He shows him the thing about the blood and stuff and the Nile River. And so Moses and Aaron, they returned to Egypt and they called all the elders of Israel together, just like God told them to do. He said, get the leaders together. You're going to need to get them on board, lead them into this, and then they are going to help you. They're going to be essential in leading the rest of this vast multitude into following you and following God in this whole thing. And so they get the elders together. Aaron told them everything Yahweh had told Moses, and Moses performed the miraculous signs as they watched. Aaron probably would have been one of the elders, one of the leaders in this in the Hebrew population. He would have been the inside guy that Moses would have needed to get the meeting with the elders, to have credibility. Aaron does play an important role in this whole thing. And so Moses performs the signs. Everybody's amazed to see the power of God. Everybody, it says that the elders, the people, believed. They believed Yahweh. And so they placed their trust in Yahweh. And it says, in fact, when they heard Yahweh was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and they worshiped. And so for them to realize that all these years, Yahweh has not been ignoring us. That's God's name for himself, Yahweh. All these years, he hasn't been ignoring us. He's heard us. He cares about us. He's just been waiting for exactly the right time to get exactly the right people in place. And now God is going to set us free. And so they're believing, they're worshiping God, they're bowing down, they're praising God. You know, this is just like all the books about ministry, you know, where you just show up, you say the right thing, everybody listens, everybody's on board. Serving God, it's just so easy. Three easy steps to serving God. Hear from God, tell people what God says, everybody listens, everybody rejoices. And then Exodus chapter 5. After this presentation to Israel's leaders, Moses and Aaron went and spoke to Pharaoh. So they gain an audience with Pharaoh, maybe arranged through Moses' connections from when he was younger. There was a chance to go and speak before the king back in these days. And so these guys, they wait their turn. They get up in there maybe a week or two later. I don't know how much time passes. And remember what God told them to say to Pharaoh. He said, "Tell him, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us." Gives them very explicit instructions. And then say, "So please let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to Yahweh our God." Now, this whole business about why is he only asking for a 3-day journey when really he wants to set them free and never come back again. Is this like disingenuous? Is he being shady or dishonest? Well, first of all, Pharaoh knew exactly what Moses was asking for. You know, if you read the rest of the narrative, you can tell he knows they're not just going for a little weekend trip. God knew that Pharaoh would not even agree to the 3-day trip, much less to his call to let the people go forever. Another thing, too, you know, he knew what Moses was asking for. It's kind of like when somebody asks you for the remote control. You're like, okay, you don't just want to hold the remote. You want to change the channel, right? If somebody's like, "Can I borrow your keys?" It's not like they just like walking around with your keys. They want your car. If somebody's like, "Hey, you got a second?" They don't just want a second. They want probably a long time to talk to you. And so he understood this. Another thing to point out, too, is, you know, Moses said, "I want to take him on a 3-day journey into the wilderness." He never said he was bringing him back. So technically, he did a 3-day journey, and then they just kept on going. But let's remember, God gave him very specific instructions. What are you supposed to say when you get in there to Pharaoh? "We want to take a, God of the Hebrews has met with us. Let's take a 3-day journey to offer sacrifices to Yahweh our God." Let's see what he says. They told him, "This is what Yahweh, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go so they may hold a festival in my honor in the wilderness." Well, that's not what Yahweh told him to say, is it? You know, I don't know if just the pressure of the moment got to them, if they got kind of like the adrenaline going, or maybe they just blurted out whatever came to mind. But that's not what God told them to say. "Is that so?" retorted Pharaoh. "And who is Yahweh? Why should I listen to him and let Israel go? I don't know Yahweh, and I will not let Israel go." You know, this is like some made-up deity name. It's like, "The God Jubawuba has come to me and says, let all of your slaves go and they should come with me." And he's like, "Well, Jubawuba must not be a very good God since all of his people have been under my control for 400 years. Get out of here. What's all this made up religion, made up deities, this God who is no God? Get out of here." Well, when Moses is done, Pharaoh's not going to be saying, "I don't know who Yahweh is." He's going to acknowledge the superiority of Yahweh as the only God, the God who is there. But Aaron and Moses persisted. "No, the God of the Hebrews has met with us," they declared. So here they start to say what Yahweh told them to say. Let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness so we can offer sacrifices to Yahweh our God. So they're backpedaling here. They're saying what they were supposed to say now, word for word. They're doing pretty well until they add this part. If we don't, he's going to kill us with a plague or the sword. Yahweh never said that either. They're changing what he said. They're adding to what he said. He's going to harm the Egyptians with plagues. He did say that. Maybe that's what they should be telling Pharaoh. But here they are. They basically go in and they don't do it right. Here they're stepping up. Here's their time, their big time to shine here, to say the thing God told them to say. They get their opportunity and they fumble. They drop the ball. Moses and Aaron, why are you distracting the people from their tasks? Get back to work. Look, there are many of your people in the land. You're stopping them from their work. Well, that same day, Pharaoh starts thinking about this a little bit more. He sent an order to the Egyptian slave drivers and the Israelite foremen. It was Pharaoh had Egyptian slave drivers who apparently were over the Israelite foremen who then kind of organized the rest of the labor projects. And he says, no more straw for bricks. Make the people get it themselves. Still require them, though, to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They're lazy. That's why they're crying out, let us go and offer sacrifices to our God. You know, they got all this extra energy. You know, let's burn some of this religious energy off, this daydreaming energy. You know, maybe we just haven't been working them hard enough. And so he sends down this order. Straw was a real important part of the brick-making process. It was what held, as the brick baked, it was mud and straw. As it baked, that's what held the brick together. Load them down with more work. Make them sweat. That'll teach them to listen to lies. So Pharaoh's trying to break their spirit. He's trying to turn the people against Moses and Aaron, and it's really a pretty good plan. It's basically going to work out at first the way that he intended it. So the slave drivers and the foremen went out and they told the people, this is what Pharaoh says, I will not provide any more straw for you. Go and get it yourselves. Find it wherever you can, but you must produce just as many bricks as before. So the people scattered throughout the land of Egypt in search of stubble to use as straw. The stubble, you know, you've got the big part of the straw, okay, and they would harvest that, and what would be left is a little nubbin at the bottom, the part that was attached to the ground down there in the dirt, and this is the stubble. And so in the absence of straw, they basically had to go out. They had to get down. They had to kind of yank the stubble out by the roots. They had to pick all the dirt out of there. They had to go back and they had to try to make do with inferior materials. And yet still they had to make the same amount of bricks. And so here they are. By day, they're still working and sweating and being whipped. And then at night, they have to go back out. They have to work second shift and they go back and they have to gather more stubble to try to use in the bricks the next day. Meanwhile, the Egyptian slave drivers continued to push hard. Meet your daily quota of bricks, just as you did when we provided you with straw, they demanded. They whipped the Israelite foreman they had put in charge of the work crews. They're bringing up Israelites leaders and they're whipping them to try to wring even more work out of them. You know, Moses, he's really going into detail on this. He's showing, you know, he didn't have to narrate all this, and yet he's showing how much the people were suffering. He's showing the brutality of the Egyptians, that they deserve what they're going to get. And, you know, he's trying to help us understand the life of the Hebrews and what this really meant for them. Why haven't you met your quotas yesterday or today, they demanded. And so the Israelite foremen, the leaders of the Israelites, they get a coalition together to go in and plead with Pharaoh. They say, please don't treat your servants like this. We're given no straw, but the slave drivers still demand, make bricks. We're being beaten. It isn't our fault. Your own people are to blame. Pharaoh, there must be some mix-up here. Surely you would not ask us to make the same number of bricks without giving us straw. But Pharaoh shouted, you're just lazy, lazy. That's why you're saying, let us go and offer sacrifices to Yahweh. Now, get back to work. No straw will be given you, but you must still produce the full quota of bricks. And so they leave, stunned, realizing this is not going to change. Our lives just got permanently harder. All of our expectations that we're going to get out of here, in fact, things have not gotten any better. Things have gotten a lot worse. And as they leave, Moses and Aaron are waiting outside to see how this meeting with Pharaoh went. And so as they left Pharaoh's court, Moses and Aaron are like, so, how did it go with Pharaoh? And they confronted Moses and Aaron, who are waiting outside for them. The foreman said to them, may Yahweh judge and punish you for making us stink before Pharaoh and his officials. You've put a sword in their hands, an excuse to kill us. Moses, ever since you tried to lead for God, our lives have just gotten worse. Ever since you showed up, there's been nothing but harm done to us. And they say, may God curse you. God damn you, Moses and Aaron. Get out of here. You know, life was hard before, but it's so much worse now since you opened your mouth. It's so much worse now since you got our hopes up. That's, you know, here you are with all your talk of freedom. What fools we were to believe you. Life is even harder now, and this must not be God's will. Must not be. You know, before, a couple of weeks ago, they're all belief. They're all like, oh, praise Yahweh. But now look at them. But really, what's changed? What's changed in the meantime? God hasn't changed. God's plan hasn't changed. God is still in control of this whole thing. And yet, the only thing that's changed is now they're suffering. And they never assumed that following God might make their lives harder. Which, you know, when has following God ever been easy? When has following God ever been comfortable? You know, that's just part. I mean, this life is going to be hard no matter what. Following God is no exception. The difference is when you're following God, you do have his guarantee that he's going to use every suffering in your life for good. You do have his guarantee that he's not going to let anything into your life that's greater than you can handle. In fact, nothing can come into your life without his permission. And so their conclusion is that the leader must be wrong. Here's the leaders actually calling on them to do what God wanted them to do, and yet it's making their life harder, and they're like, look, we're not abandoning Yahweh. We're just rejecting you. In fact, they were doing both. And this is one of the painful things. You know, Moses and Aaron, they knew that Pharaoh was going to reject them at first. I don't think they saw this coming. That the people of God, that Aaron, his brothers who he and sisters, the fellow Hebrews, he'd been with them for 83 years, suffering, brick making, encouraging them to keep on going. And here they turn on him at what's supposed to be the greatest moment when they need to stick together. And so they think the leader must be wrong because why would God want me to suffer? And this is one of the painful parts about following God is how you step forward and you open up your life to people, you open up your heart to people, you expose yourself, and then people turn on you. And they attack. And they curse you, and they invoke the name of God against you. And I love what Ajith Fernando has to say about this. He's the director of Youth for Christ in Sri Lanka, his book, A Call to Joy and Pain. He says, Sri Lanka has faced a lot of pain in the past 25 years. We've had a war in the north and the east, a revolution in the south, a devastating tsunami, several floods and epidemics, and persecution of Christians doing evangelism. We don't have to deal with much of any of that. Sometimes my friends abroad mention how fortunate that they are that they do not have to live with so much pain. Indeed, they're fortunate, but if I'm able, I tell them that my greatest pain over the past 25 years has not been from any of these tragedies that struck Sri Lanka. Indeed, there has been fear, frustration, sorrow, and anxiety, but the greatest pain has been from relationships, and it will always be the greatest pain we face. The relational pain. The pain of seeing people turn their back on God, the pain of seeing people attack you when you're trying to just say what God told you to say, when you're doing your best imperfectly. It's the pain that comes from being committed to people. And Christians will face that wherever they live. If you're faithful to God, sometimes people won't like you. In fact, Jesus said, beware when all people speak well of you. That's really an unusual position. In the history of serving God, when have God's leaders ever been popular? When has it ever been easy to serve God? A Christian life that's comfortable, luxurious, well-liked by all, that's a suspect Christian life. It's not that we go out seeking suffering, but it tends to come in doses of varying sizes when we're being faithful to God. And so will you serve God faithfully is the question. This is part of the cost that needs to be counted. You know, the thought that Moses says yes to God and then it's just this fairy tale ending from then on out. No. This was a little closer to the beginning of a nightmare than a fairy tale. The pain that would come into his life, the thought that, well, the hard part's over. No, every step along the way, as we face suffering, we need to say yes again and again. God retests and calls us to reaffirm our earlier decision. And so will you be faithful to God? And will you do it even when you see your own failings? Remember, Moses, he didn't do it exactly right. He went into Pharaoh. They said the wrong thing. They changed what God said. They added to what God said. And one of the hard things about a leader, one of the things that leaves me up sleepless at night sometimes is the thought that I didn't do it exactly right. That I did it wrong, actually. I said the wrong thing. As a leader, you're thrust into this position where you've got to be quick on your feet, and a lot of times I'm a day late on thinking what I should have said. And you relive that interaction. You relive that decision. You see how that actually turned out. You see your own shortcomings coming to stare you right in the face. You see yourself hurt people and you realize, I did the wrong thing there. And as imperfect people trying to serve God, who is the perfect God, you know, this is part of the toll. This is what grinds us down. This is what makes people want to quit altogether, because they realize it's almost like things were a lot better off before I did anything. And that I feel like I'm to blame for the pain that's being caused to other people. And so we're going to see our own failings. There's been a number of instances, especially in my life over the past year, where I found myself kicking myself for doing the wrong thing. Cases where I was kind of thrust into the forefront. I didn't do it right. People were mad at me. I would do it differently if I could. You know, that part of what we get from that is we learn from our mistakes. Part of, though, what we get is we have to learn a new level of living under God's grace. You know, God's forgiveness that covers over our shortcomings. That's part of what we need to learn. It's part of what makes us fit to lead for God. The failure that we experience. You know, to turn the camera another way, though, another lesson we can learn from this, another question we can ask ourselves, is how leadable are you? That's one of the things that really sticks out about not just this account, but the rest of Moses' life, is how unleadable God's people are, how fickle they are. My kids have this great Bible. It's called the Action Bible. And it's a rewrite of this old picture Bible that I had when I was a kid. But it's this guy who used to draw for DC and Marvel Comics and stuff. But I love the scenes from Moses' life, because for several of them, the scene will end and the people will be like, wow, we were so wrong to not trust Moses. We'll never do that again. And it's done with this tongue-in-cheek. It's really funny. But it just shows it highlights how fickle they are, how suffering really changes their perspective. And I wonder, you know, I've seen this in my own heart before too, where a leader was calling on me to do something. And I was like, God would never want that. I hate you. Curses upon you from God. And then later I realized actually they were right. And I was being such a pain in the neck. It was pasted over with this kind of spiritual veneer, when really it was just covering up my own selfish heart. And I've seen this many times. People will go the way that they want to go that way, and they're like, well, God said this or that or whatever. And you know, it's I wonder if we should be a little bit less quick to shake our fist at a leader who is imperfect. Your leaders are going to be imperfect, okay? They're messed up. You know, let's not pretend that they're going to do everything right. That's part of why we're all in this together. We're trying to follow God together. I wonder if we should be maybe a little bit more hesitant to cast suspicion, a little bit more quick to cast suspicion on my own unwillingness to even listen here, and on my own anger in this whole thing. And it's one thing to disagree. It's another thing to be angry about it. And that should be a warning flag as well. So how leadable are you? Are you a little bit too much like the Israelites here? I wonder. Moses, then, after he gets chewed out by the people, he goes and he yells at God. Why have you brought all this trouble on your own people, Lord? Why did you send me? See, I was right. I was not the right guy for this. And you, ever since I got here, you've brought harm on your people, God. So the people are blaming Moses. Moses is blaming God. Moses is also blaming Pharaoh. Ever since I came to Pharaoh as your spokesman, he has been even more brutal to your people. People are like, Moses, it's your fault. He's like, God, it's your fault, and it's Pharaoh's fault. He's a mess. I like that he's going to God, though, with this. We need to be honest with God. If we're ever going to make it, we're going to have to be honest with God, and emotionally honest. Not that we stay in this place. We've got to work our way back over onto truth, but getting those emotions out there, that's an important part of this as well. And he says, you've done nothing to rescue them. Really? Is that true? As a matter of fact, God has actually done quite a bit to rescue his people. God could have responded with any of a number of points. He could have pointed out, what about that plan I launched long ago? Before I even created anything, when I knew that these humans would turn against me, they would rebel against me even though I had been nothing but good to them. The arrangement I made with my son before the foundations of the world that he would go wade into the human race, that he would be mocked and abused and tortured by these people, that he would offer himself up on a cross to die for them, to offer forgiveness freely to anyone that would receive it. What about that plan? Not, what about my plan to protect and grow my people? You know, why is there even an Israelite nation in the first place? It's because of me. Why is it that Pharaoh has not stamped these people out? It's because of me. It's because I'm the one that's rescued them, and it's because I'm working on an even bigger rescue plan, which is going to involve the whole human race. Forgiveness for all through these people, through a descendant, Jesus Christ, that would come from the Israelites. What about that, Moses? Have you overlooked that part of this whole thing? Moses, you have no idea what I've been doing to rescue these people. What about preparing a rescuer? Think about the challenges before the deliverer of this people. Think what a complicated job description that's going to be. Talk about an HR nightmare. You know, what is the job description for the rescuer? You know, rescuers, they don't just grow on trees. Negotiate with Pharaoh. How are you going to get in? You know, you're going to need somebody that knows how to navigate all the politics of Egyptian palace life. Somebody that's got connections. Somebody that has spent years studying how to get things done, who to talk to, what is proper protocol. Where are you going to get that? If only you could find somebody who spent the first 40 years of his life raised in that very palace, probably friends, childhood friends with some of the people that are in charge right now, including Pharaoh, somebody who knows exactly how to get things done in the Egyptian courts. Well, Moses, I guess that wasn't a waste of time in his life, was it? He had no idea how much God was going to use that later on as part of his plan. You're going to need somebody who can win the trust of the Hebrews. That's going to be pretty hard for an outsider. That's going to be hard for some palace boy. Although, if you could find a guy who was ethnically a Hebrew, who had spent the first 3 years of his life with his family right there in that slave population, who had a brother who'd spent 83 years with the Hebrews, who had their trust, who could vouch for Moses, that'd be a pretty good arrangement, don't you think? And that's exactly what God did in Moses. He gave him the exact qualifications that he would need to at least have a chance to win the people's trust. And even with that, it was pretty challenging. To lead a nation, think about how complex it would be to lead this vast multitude of the Israelites. You know, there's so many challenges that come with governing a huge body of people. If only you could find a guy that had been groomed to lead the most powerful nation on earth, who had been trained in every aspect of administration, you know, how to get our food, how to arrange people, how to govern people. If only you could find a guy like that. Well, Moses had all the best that the world had to offer at that point. He had been trained in the top public administration, public policy school in the world, Egypt. This guy's going to need to be able to write everything down. In an age when the literacy rate was a couple of percentage points, the rescuer is going to need to write approximately 5 books of scripture. He's going to need to teach the people to write and read if they're going to pass this down. Moses would have been fluent probably in multiple languages, able to write in multiple languages, and that's exactly what he did. He wrote it all down, and he taught the people how to read and how to write. To navigate to Sinai, think about this vast wilderness, a wilderness that could break even the most courageous adventurer, much less somebody that's been raised in a soft, you know, the couches of kings. And yet Moses had spent the last 40 years running around that Sinai desert, moving his herds from here to there, knowing where to get water, knowing where to move at this time of year, knowing that's the part we need to just stay away from. You know, he spent 40 years of his life. This was like his backyard by now. He knew it like the back of his hand, and he's going to need that if he's going to lead the people through this desert to survive for 40 years. All the skills he learned as a tribal nomad with the Midianites are going to be brought fully to bear. God knew exactly what he was preparing Moses for, and Moses had no idea. You know, you think about it, in that 40th year in the desert, as he herded this flock of obstinate, dense sheep around, how could he have guessed that a year later he's going to be herding this flock of obstinate, dense Israelites around that exact same desert? God was working in Moses' life when Moses had no idea. And what you may find is that times in your life that you felt like were wasted years, years where even by your own choices, you made some bad choices, you suffered. Even years where maybe you were far from God, the family you were brought up in, the training that you got, God doesn't waste any of that. In fact, God has, as we saw last week, God has good works prepared for you to do that he prepared before you were ever created. And you'd be surprised how much of the things you did in the past God puts to use now. Trusting God would be maybe the hardest thing on this list. You know, that's not something that just happens overnight. That's not something you can just pull up to a drive-through window and have them hand out in a paper sack. You know, trusting God, the only way to get that is years, decades really, of times where it looks like God's not going to come through, times where nobody's looking, times where God calls on you to act, times where even harder, God calls on you to wait patiently. And we struggle and we complain and we wrestle our will back in line with his, and then we see God come through and our faith grows. And then next time we wait a little longer, and then God comes through and we see God growing our faith through these small steps, through bigger steps. He's building something in Moses here. And even now that he's arrived in Egypt, God's not done with him. This whole insertion, chapters 5 and 6, God didn't need to do that. Why not jump straight to the plagues? It's because he's still working in Moses' life. He's still preparing him. He's trying to teach Moses, what do you do when all the Israelites are against you? What do you do when they're calling down curses on you? That's not the last time this is going to happen, Moses. You're going to need to learn how to turn to God in the midst of that and to get your strength from him. Because it can be a little lonely at times. And so he's teaching Moses to trust God. And I love what Miles Stanford has to say about how God works in our lives through suffering and even through failure. That's part of what Moses is going to have to grapple with, is when his own shortcomings cause things to go wrong, what is he going to do? Is he going to sit there and beat himself up? Is he going to quit? Or is he going to keep trying to move forward with God? Stanford says, it seems that most believers have difficulty in realizing and facing up to the inexorable fact that God does not hurry in his development of our Christian life. He's working from and for eternity. You know, when God looks at things from the perspective of eternity, you know, a couple of years doesn't seem that long. Even a couple of decades. You know, that's really a pretty small amount of time for the kind of work that God's doing in our lives. It's more than comforting to realize, too, that it's those who have plumbed the depths of failure to whom God invariably gives the call to shepherd others. Yes, our own failure, not far from disqualifying us, can actually be the thing that qualifies us to lead for God. It's not a call given to the gifted or highly trained or the polished as such. Without a bitter experience of their own inadequacy and poverty, they're quite unfitted to bear the burden of spiritual ministry. Yeah, early in our Christian lives, the answers come so quickly. We're so black and white. It just seems so easy, and people who fail just seem so pathetic and weak. And then we get some failure under our own belts. We get some suffering under our own belts, and we realize the shame that we feel when we fail. We realize that pain of beating myself up, of laying up at night, unable to sleep, because I know that I did it wrong. Seeing my own shortcomings and having to face that squarely, it's really that. That is really what helps us to understand what it means to be weak and also what it means to come back and to experience God's grace. It takes a man who's discovered something of the measures of his own weakness to be patient with the foibles of others. That's the only way to get empathy, is to see your own weakness and to be like, I know how you feel. And it takes someone who's felt that and who's been built up by God that is able to speak to somebody who's wallowing in failure, who's wallowing in shame, who feels like they've blown it and can never recover again. Such a man also has firsthand knowledge of the loving care of the chief shepherd and his ability to heal one who has come humbly to trust in him and him alone. Part of what God is stripping away is our self-confidence, our trust in ourselves. Therefore, he does not easily despair of others, but looks beyond sinfulness, willfulness, and stupidity to the might of unchanging love. Yes, what it helps us do is it helps us see past the exterior. It helps us see God's vision for people. It helps us see not what this person is, but what they could be. It helps us to filter out the sinfulness, willfulness, and stupidity, because you realize how accurately those describe me. And you see how God's worked with me, and then you kind of learn from how he's worked with you how to work with other people. And it gives you hope, and it gives you confidence in God to work through people who have problems. People who can't even see anything good in themselves, and yet God knows that this broken vessel here can be used tremendously to shine forth my grace and love and my truth. And so Moses comes back to God, and God could have said a lot of different things to Moses about his plan, about how he's protected the people, about how he's worked in Moses' life, and yet what God says is something different. Now you'll see what I'll do to Pharaoh. He turns back to the task at hand. When he feels the force of my strong hand, he will let the people go. In fact, he will force them to leave his land. He won't even let them stay when I'm done with them, okay? And so God is turning, just like last week we saw, God is turning the focus back onto himself, which is exactly where it needs to be for Moses to persevere in this. And God said to Moses, just like last time, I'm Yahweh. He reminds Moses of who he is. I am Yahweh. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, God Almighty. That was a different name that he went by. But I didn't reveal my name, Yahweh, to them. All right, it doesn't mean they didn't know the name Yahweh. You see that all over the pages of Genesis. What it means is, now you're going to see why they call me Yahweh. They never really saw it. You know, the power that God's going to unleash here in the plagues of Egypt, honestly, we're never going to see that again except for when God the Son was walking around here on earth. That kind of miraculous power revealed. This is the second greatest revelation of God's power that we know about in the history of the human race. He says, now they're going to see why they call me Yahweh. It's like, you know, you're having coffee with Superman. And you're like, so I hear they call you Superman, but I mean, why is that? And he looks up and somebody's robbing a bank across the street. And he, boom, 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 ties him up, leaves him there for the cops. Zooms back over, grabs a seat, and he's like, now you see why they call me Super. I mean, you'd heard my name, but now you've seen it for yourself, how I got that name, the great I am. He says, I reaffirm my covenant, my promises with them. God's promises, that's part of what he keeps turning attention back to. I promise to give them the land of Canaan, where they're living as foreigners. I'm the God that keeps my promises. You can be sure I've heard the groans of the people of Israel who are now slaves to the Egyptians. I'm the God who hears my people. I haven't overlooked any of that. Remember, he kept saying that last week too. I'm well aware of my covenant with them, my promises to them. Therefore, say to the people of Israel, I am Yahweh. Again, he says that. I will free you from your oppression. I'm the God who does something. I'm the God who sets people free from their bonds. I will rescue you from your slavery in Egypt. I will keep my promises. I will redeem you with a powerful arm and great acts of judgment. I'm the God of redemption. What is he turning their attention to? I am and I will. I am and I will. And he gives us seven I wills here. I will claim you as my own people. I'm the God of relationship. I'm the God of intimacy. I will be your God. And then you will know that I'm Yahweh, your God who's freed you from your oppression in Egypt. I will bring you into the land that I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm the God that keeps my promises. I will give it to you as your very own possession. I am Yahweh. And he ends the same way that he started. And so Moses, in his moment of despair, he comes and he sits before God, and God builds him back up again. This is why we need to have daily time with God, to talk to him, to get filled up by him, to get redirected by him, to get reminded by him. And so Moses, it says, oh yeah, I love this quote from Hendrickson. Every problem a person has is related to his concept of God. If you have a big God, you have small problems. If you have a small God, you have big problems. It's as simple as that. And so Moses, it's not like his problems got any smaller. What happened was he remembered how big of a God he was serving. And our problems seem to shrink and even disappear altogether sometimes when we remember God. He just gets so much bigger. And that's why Thanksgiving, that's why thanking God is so important. That's why praising God is such an important part of the time that we spend with him. If we just come talking about our problems get bigger. We need to start with a reminder of who he is and what he's promised. And then look at our problems in that light. And so this is exactly what Moses gets. He gets built up by God. And he goes back to the people of Israel, it says. And he told them what Yahweh had said. Yahweh came to me again. And here's what he said. And here's what he's going to do. And here's the plan. And And they wouldn't listen anymore. Well, that's not supposed to happen. they'd become too discouraged by the brutality of their slavery. They're like, you know, Moses, I thought we already had this conversation. Look, I got to get back to work. I got to work tonight. I got to work tomorrow. I got to work every day this week. And that's never going to end now, thanks to you. Maybe if you would shut up, maybe we could go back to at least things before, where the slavery wasn't quite as bad. And so Yahweh comes to Moses in this moment of need, and he says, all right, let's go back to Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Tell him to let the people of Israel leave his country. Moses is like, Yahweh, you don't get it, dude. My own people won't listen to me anymore. How can I expect Pharaoh to listen? I'm such a clumsy speaker. Well, we've heard that before, haven't we? That's one of his great reasons why he was not the right guy for the job. Why he's not fit to be a leader. Why God can't use him. And what we see is that his early experiences, they only seemed to confirm his objections, his sense of inadequacy. It's amazing how these insecurities will cling on. And how you'll be a grown adult, and you've still got these things coming back through your head, which is the way I saw myself as a 14-year-old boy, you know? It's like the ways we view ourselves, it takes a while for those to die. And we see Moses here, having already had this answered, goes right back to his same old insecurity. And he seems like he's got the experience to show that he's right. And so when things get hard, how are you going to respond? When you say yes to God and things get hard, are you going to go back and are you going to change your mind? Or are you going to let God drive his truths even deeper? Because he obviously kind of agreed and he kind of didn't. And he's got a choice to make again, and this is how we get more convinced or less, is these decision points, these points of crisis, suffering. But Yahweh doesn't even respond. He speaks to Moses and Aaron and gave them orders for the Israelites and for Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, which sounds kind of like not empathetic, but he's done plenty of empathy here. Really, what Moses needs is he needs to act. Sometimes that's what we need to help people do who are feeling sorry for themselves. Acting can help you get the tension off yourself. It also helps you start to see God come through. He commanded Moses and Aaron to lead the people out of Egypt. And so we see in chapter 7, God says, pay close attention to this. Which is probably a little reminder of how they didn't the first time they went to Pharaoh. Are you listening now? Have we learned our lesson? Tell Aaron everything I command you. Aaron must command Pharaoh to let the people of Israel leave his country. And how did they do? Well, it says Moses was 80 years old and Aaron was 83 when they made their demands to Pharaoh. And so here we have Moses and Aaron, aged 80 and 83, hobbling in for round two with the most powerful monarch in the world, ready to demand that he let their people go. Here they are, aged 80 and 83, finally ready to start doing the task that they were made for. Their training is finally at a point where they can move into the next phase here. And it says, they went to Pharaoh and did just as Yahweh had commanded them. Guess they learned a little something from that first experience, didn't they? To say exactly what God said. That's going to become important, too, as their life goes on. Well, let's just try and summarize here. What have we seen from this episode in the lives of Moses and Aaron? Well, the main thing here is that when you say yes to God's call, life might get even harder. We're going to have to be prepared for that. We're going to have to be prepared for taking flack from other people, like they did. We're going to have to be prepared for seeing our own shortcomings, one of the most painful parts of all of them. To take flack because of my shortcomings. We're going to be haunted by our old insecurities. Don't think those have gone away. You just need to be ready with an answer for those. To answer with God's grace. And we're going to have to be prepared for agonizingly slow process. Moses, you know, he's disappointed that it's taken a couple of weeks. He needs to buckle in for 40 years here, because that's where this is headed. But what we've got to see is that in Moses' life and in our lives, in the long run, it's so much better to say yes to God, to follow God into whatever he's got for me. You know, Moses, if you asked him today, would you do it all over again? He would say definitely. And if you think about the suffering that he experienced is also paired with benefits that only come from saying yes to God. Like you get to see God's special preparation for the task. You look back and see the way God has designed me and also the experiences I've had. That's exactly what I needed for this thing that God has for me. Moses got to see that. He wrote it all down for us. We see God's extraordinary comfort. You know, it was Moses. If he hadn't stepped forward and been in this pain that he was in, I don't think he would have gone to God to receive such a revelation of God's power, of God's character. One who spoke with God face to face, it feels like that sometimes. And as we suffer for following God, what we get promised is an extra dose of his comfort and his presence and his power that you really only find through suffering. Moses got to see God's power working through him, to see God unleashing miracles that nobody's ever done since. That'd be something. And what we see is that we'll see God's power moving through us in ways that we didn't expect, and ways that we'll sit back someday in awe of what he did. And finally, Moses got to lead the captives to freedom. Think about being there that night when Pharaoh finally released the people, to see the tears of the Israelites, the old, you know, grandmas and grandpas who realize my grandchildren aren't going to have to be raised as slaves. The kids who are embarking on this new adventure, heading out for the promised land, no longer under the whip of the taskmaster anymore, to stand there and to see the people are free now. Moses, today as he looks back from heaven, and he sees not just that, but what God did since then, he's not regretting any of that, and you will not either. Because what we get to lead people into is an even greater freedom. Not the freedom from physical slavery, but the freedom from spiritual slavery, the freedom from death that God offers through his Son freely to anyone who's willing to accept his offer. That's what you get to experience. And that's what you get to look back on as Christ says, well done, good and faithful servant. We thank you, God, that you had a rescue plan for the Israelites, just like you have a rescue plan, a bigger rescue plan for the whole human race, God, and those were related. Thank you for the freedom that you offer, God. Thanks that we get to play any part in being messengers of that news to people, that we get to see people set free, we get to see people transformed, God. And thanks, too, that even when there are setbacks, we know that you're in there with us, that your promises are the same, that your power is the same. Thanks, too, God, for how patient you are in working with us to make us the kind of people that can be used by you. And I pray, God, that for some of us here that are discouraged and have seen our own failure, that we would not see that as reasons why we should just never try again, reasons why it's okay to say no, but instead that we would instead take a different perspective on that, that that might be the thing you want to use to make us more gracious, more empathetic, more patient, more wise, God. Pray we can learn from these things that have happened and to continue to step forward and be willing to let you lead us into the work that you have for us to do. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.